Now, for various reasons, there are certain verses in the Bible, in the book of Revelation in particular, that have become famous in our day and age. And one of those is Revelation chapter 13, and it's the final verse, isn't it? Verse 18. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and that number is 666. When I was a boy, we had a book at home called Let the Bible Speak. My parents had got it from a lady. They said to me, I said, well, what religion was she? She said, oh, I don't know. She used to go to church on a Saturday, they said. So I guess she was a Seventh-day Adventist, and it was. It's one of the phrases that Seventh-day Adventists use. Let the Bible speak. And in this fascinating book, there was a page where it showed you that the Pope was 666. It wrote out his one of his titles then, Vicarius Filii Dei, representative of the Son of God. And it showed you that if you take the letters as numbers, you know, the Latins and the Greeks and the Hebrews, they use letters then for numbers. And if you add it all up, it came to 666. And now I've got nothing positive to say about the Pope at all. But I don't think that that's the way to show that 666 is actually pointing to the Pope. You can do it with Napoleon. You can do it with Muhammad. There are all sorts of people. They call it gematria. It's the Hebrews that are very keen on it, and it's called gematria. I even saw one person had done it with Ellen Gould White. She's normally called Ellen White, but she's Ellen Gould White. And if you do that the right way, you'll get the numbers 666. She's the founder of the Seventh-day Adventist movement. So I don't think there's much. I don't think that's the way to understand 666. I do hope to explain. If you sit tight. As I say, it's going to be a little bit longer than normal, the sermon, but if you sit tight, I will explain to you, as far as I can, 666, but you'll have to wait till the end for that. So we're in the second half now, aren't we, of the book of Revelation, and we've begun to look at the fourth section of the book then, chapters 12 to 14. Now, chapter 12 contains three successive visions featuring three main characters. Then you've got the pregnant woman who gives birth. You've got the child she gives birth to, and then you've got this enormous great red dragon. And we've said that the woman stands for the church, then for God's people, first of all, the Old Testament church before the coming of Messiah, and then later of the New Testament church. And then the child she gives birth to, of course, that is the Messiah. The dragon is unable to destroy the Messiah because he's snatched up to heaven then. But the dragon then turns on the woman. Satan is persecuting and attacking the church. And here in chapter 13, then, we're introduced to Satan's agents, then, the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth. And this rather frightening pair, then, they represent symbolically, then, two routes along which Satan, he was working then and he's still working today. And in chapter 14, just so that we don't miss that, we'll begin, I think, on a third route that Satan also uses. But back in chapter 13 now, you've got, first of all, a beast of indescribable horror coming out of the sea. It's like the description of Leviathan that you've got there in the book of Job. And I suggest to you that this beast, this monster, stands for the persecuting power of nations and their governments. But then there's a second beast. This one comes from the earth, I suppose, like the behemoth that we also read about in the book of Job. And, it appears to be harmless, first of all. But it's clearly not, and that's the reason why it's more dangerous. And I would suggest to you that as a sort of an overall description then, that the second beast stands for the forces of false religion and of heresy, particularly then when it is hand in glove with the state, with governments. So these two, they work hand in glove in their efforts to somehow or other subvert and overthrow the gospel. And John gives us a vision then that's, well, it's very much informed by his own particular time, his own particular situation. But these beasts, I would suggest to you, they weren't just at work in John's day, but they have continued to be at work down the ages, and they're still at work today. And we ought to be fully aware of their operations. And so I want to say two things to you this morning, two main things I want to say to you. First of all, beware of satanic forces at work, let's say in politics today. I'm using the word politics in a very sort of broad sense. So beware, or be aware, I suppose it should be, of Satan or satanic forces at work in politics today. And the first point is that we should expect satanically inspired governments to arise. So you come to the end of chapter 12, you come into the chapter 13, and you've got this dragon then, Satan it stands for, standing on the shore of the sea. And behind the two beasts that we learn about in chapter 13 is the devil himself. Satan then is behind what goes on. And we need to remember that. The dragon stands looking for help, if you like. And first from the one side then, John sees a beast coming out of the sea. Now, when you read about the sea in the book of Revelation, it's usually talking about the nations of the world and their governments then. Especially the idea of the nations in turmoil. So, for example, if you go back to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 17 and verse 12, you've got these words, "Oh, the raging of many nations. They rage like," what do they rage like? "They rage like the raging sea." It's like the sea then, churning up. "Oh, the uproar of the peoples. They roar like the roaring of great waters." And so in Revelation itself, in chapter 17 and verse 15, John is told, "The waters you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages." So when we're thinking about the seas then, we're thinking about the nations of the world. And I suppose there's, you know, when Israel was attacked, they were attacked from all sorts of directions. But sometimes the opposition would come from the sea. It's on the edge of the Mediterranean Sea, isn't it? And sometimes the attack then would come from the sea. And so you've got this picture. You should have this picture in your mind of this this beast, this monster, slowly emerging from the sea. And first of all, John sees his horns and his heads then. Just like the dragon then, there are 10 horns, there are 7 heads. And the 10 crowns are on the horns then, and on each head a blasphemous name. And then follows the beast itself. Well, it was like a leopard, it had feet like those of a bear, its mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And it was, of course, the dragon, Satan then, who gave the beast his power and his throne and his great authority. Now, once again, and we've seen this through Revelation, John is drawing on Daniel chapter 7, where you get this sort of description. Daniel 7 refers to leopards and lions and bears and horns. In that vision, it's successive evil empires then, hostile to God's people, that are described. But here, if you like, we've got it sort of the whole thing combined. A combined vision then of what is in fact, yes, a succession of evil empires. The horns, the heads, the crowns remind us then of the pride, the power, the authority of states then that oppose the truth. I mean, a little thing here, but the dragon has the crowns on his heads and the beast has the crowns on its horns, which I suppose is saying that Satan rules then, while the nations, of course, use their strength to carry out the rule then of Satan. So I think even the details sometimes teach us things, don't they? So Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, one after another then, they rise up and they persecute the people of God. One after another then, they rise against believers. And their anti-Christian outlook is symbolized by these blasphemous names that John tells us he can see on their crowns. And so the point for us this morning is that we're to expect those sorts of things. There are obvious examples today: North Korea, Somalia, Eritrea, the Maldives. It's claimed that in the Maldives, all citizens are Muslims. If you're from the Maldives, you're a Muslim, regardless then of what you may want to think. It is illegal there to propagate any religion other than Islam. And even in countries then where it isn't as tight as that, there can often be anti-Christian policies in our own country. We know that every now and again there's a move towards what could be considered to be an anti-Christian policy. And so we ought to expect that. We shouldn't be surprised at that. Expect satanically inspired state. If you're trying to fill in the... I've got EG. It should be just G, isn't it? Governments. That's all I want. State governments to arise. Cross the E out. Secondly, don't be surprised then when apparently defeated evil empires resurface with renewed power. Don't be surprised when apparently defeated evil empires resurface with renewed power. So verse 3 says, one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound. So that's good, isn't it? It's gone. One of the heads has been wounded. But the fatal wound, you know, the word fatal means dead. You know, there's no more. And yet, it wasn't a fatal wound because the fatal wound had been healed. Now, the Emperor Nero had led the first great state persecution against the Christians. Perhaps you know the story of how he blamed the Christians for burning Rome. He himself had done it, but he was looking around for a scapegoat, and he thought, the Christians. Nobody likes the Christians. Let's blame the Christians. And that's what happened. Now, Nero himself, of course, did not last then. He committed suicide in AD 68. And so the Roman Empire was in really a bit of chaos at that particular point. And it, in some ways, looked as though it was finished. But then this man, Vespasian, came along, and somehow he managed over the course of 10 years to turn it round. And so by the time that John is writing, the terrible persecutions under the Emperor Domitian are beginning to have their effect there. Something from about 81 AD to 96 AD, Domitian is in power. And the fatal wound then had been healed. And so, it's a grim parody, really, isn't it, when you think about it? You know, a parody is where you copy something, but you do it in a sort of a funny way, isn't it? So, it's a grim parody of the death and the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. We see the beast fall, and yet it rises again. What is it, 25 years now since the fall of communism, fall of Russia, the Eastern Bloc, and the other communist countries. And, you know, you rejoiced. Many rejoiced, didn't they, at that? And it was a great thing to think now that communism was vanquished. You think, well, the state persecution of believers must be over now. But it's not that simple. I've been to Belarus. Belarus is just as communist as it always was. There's not been much change in Belarus, and it still continues to follow whatever Russia suggests. China, then, has often seen them to have suffered a fatal wound. You think, well, that's the end of that, then. They won't be doing what they have done. And yet the monster rises again and again, and believers are persecuted. To this day, believers in China are being persecuted. I don't think it's any different to what it was 20, 25 years ago, 35 years ago. Believers are still being persecuted. Now, again, we need to expect that. That shouldn't surprise us. We shouldn't be saying, Cuba is changing. Cuba is not like it was. And therefore, everything's going to change. Well, it's not always that simple. It's not always that simple. And we need to recognize that's the case. Third thing, don't be surprised at the popularity of evil empires that seek and receive worship there from many. Just working our way through Revelation 13, you come to the second part of verse 3, and it says that the whole world was astonished and followed the beast, and men worshipped the dragon because he'd given authority to the beast then. They also worship the beast. So there's worship of Satan, there's worship of false religion or false power, sorry. And they say, well, who's like the beast, they say? Who can make war against it? So there's a gullibility about men and women who are often impressed then with the power and the authority of the state, especially when great empires arise then. They've got extensive lands, they've got a great deal of military might, and people admire that, they look at it. You remember how Hitler very proudly boasted that he was beginning a 1,000-year Reich. And many people believed him, many people followed Hitler. And amazingly, even today, there are people who follow Hitler. You know, they're very quiet about it generally, but they say, well, you know, Hitler, a lot of good ideas and all this vile nonsense. And you'd think anybody who knew anything about that man, anything about what he did, they'd say, I don't want anything to do with it, it's evil. But no, it's not like that. People admire. They look up to it. And in John's day, the Roman emperors increasingly claimed divine power. They demanded the worship of the people. Domitian, who was the emperor at this time, he demanded to be addressed as our Lord and God. That's how you addressed the emperor of Rome, our Lord and God. And most Christians, of course, refused such blasphemy. They wouldn't. That's one of the reasons they were persecuted, because they wouldn't call Domitian their Lord and God, because they had a Lord and God, the true Lord and the true God. And so many died as a result of that. And similar things have happened then down the ages. In many countries, Christians have suffered for their refusal then to put the state above God in their allegiance. Again, you think of Hitler, think of the communists then, and the way they sought to replace faith in Christ, either with national socialism or with atheistic socialism. There's always a name for it, but it's basically the state. You serve the state. You live for the nation. You don't live for God. And again, I think we find out that this sort of thing is happening, and we're tempted to be surprised by it, but there's no reason to be surprised. It's here in the Bible pretty clearly for us. And then fourthly, we can say that we ought to realize that such pride and blasphemy will go on then throughout the gospel age. This is the pattern then, all the way from the first coming of Christ to the second coming. Verse 5 then. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies, and to exercise his authority for, well, how long? It's 42 months. So here's this this figure again that we've talked about. It comes from Daniel chapter 7, and it's a reminder that this is something then that's going to go on through this whole period between the first coming and the second coming of Christ. Whether you call it 42 months, or you call it 3.5 years, or times and half a time, they're all different ways of speaking about this unspecified length of time. And you remember the mouth is a lion's mouth. It's proud, it's fierce, it's dangerous. And proud words and blasphemies then will characterize the leaders of these states. In verse 6, we read that it opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. So it blasphemes and it slanders God. It does the same with his name. It does that with heaven and with believers. Believers, of course, they're not in heaven yet, all of them, but they are in the heavenly places then. They worship God in the heavenly places. And this monster blasphemes against all that. And then fifthly, expect evil empires to capture the minds of unbelievers and to persecute believers. Beginning of verse 7, it was given power. You notice it was given power then. There's nothing that Satan or his minions can do except by the express permission of God. Now, I know it's a difficult question. You say, well, why does God allow them to go as far as they do? And that's one of the great unanswerable questions. But that is the situation, that God does allow this to happen. And so they're allowed to make war against God's holy people and to conquer them even. And it is apparently then able to overcome believers and to crush them, to put them to death. And then in the second part of verse 7, we read that it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All the inhabitants of the earth then will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. So here the power then, I suppose, is really greater than that merely of one state. This, I suppose, is the combination of states. And that's why people talk about the United Nations as an antichrist and other movements like that. I think it's very difficult. I don't think it works in a simple way. There are definitely forces out there in the world that are trying to unite the nations in a bad way, in a way then that gives room for Satan's power. But I don't think we should just, you know, like this whole question, we got this vote, many of us, haven't we, in June about the European Union. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know whether we should be in it or not. I don't think it's clear. But certainly the way we should be thinking, well, is it likely to lead to more freedoms for God's people or less freedoms? And somehow we've got to, and I don't know the answer to that question either, but that's the way we need to think about it. And certainly the marks of Antichrist are there then in some of these organizations. They rule over unbelievers with great power. They make war against believers. They kill them. But believers, of course, can't die because their names are written in the book of life. This is the second reference in Revelation. There are six references altogether to the book of life. The book of life is the book then where the names of all the believers are written. They've all been saved by Christ, the Lamb then, the Passover Lamb who's been slain from the creation of the world then. It happened in time. But this is to do with a covenant then between the Father and the Son before the beginning of time, before the creation of the world, before the world was ever created. Christ was willing then to lay down his life for sinners like us this morning. And so the state will often be the means that Satan uses to persecute believers. I mean, persecution can come from many directions, can't it? But sometimes it is the state itself that authorizes and brings it about. One more thing then under this first heading. Take note of these things and be willing to suffer and endure. So the description of the first beast concludes with words of warning. And so there are two things for us then. First of all, take note of what is said here. The same words as we read seven times over near the beginning of this book. Here they come again then. Whoever has ears, let him hear, or let them hear. We must be aware that Satan is at work. And one of the ways that he's at work is through state governments. That's part of his policy. He leads them on to misuse their power, to gain control over the hearts and the minds of unbelievers, and to oppose and to persecute believers. And we see it, I suppose, very clearly today, particularly in Muslim lands then, where believers are very strongly opposed. But we see it also in a nation like China or in Burma, Myanmar, as they want us to call it, and many other places as well. This information is not difficult to come by. Open Doors, for example, gives you a list then of the countries that are the worst persecutors of Christians. And obviously, in this country, we're not in that position. But from time to time, then, we become aware of, you know, it's the stirring of the beast, isn't it? There are people in government, and they're not Christians. They don't like Christians. They don't agree with Christians. And the temptation, then, is for them to use their power to drive Christianity back, to oppose it in some way. And sometimes, then, individual believers are caught up in the whole machine, and they suffer because of that. And so that's the second point I want to make here in closing this opening section, that we must be willing to suffer. Verse 10 tells us that if anyone is to go into captivity, they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword, they will be killed. And John is warning his readers then that they need to be ready for prison and they need to be ready for death if it comes. And we need to be ready as well. And we need to be willing to humbly accept that sort of trouble. And I can add to that then, we need to be patient and faithful. John says, doesn't he, this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Does he use the words saints there? God's people is the phrase he uses. But God's holy ones we're talking about. So the question for us this morning is that our attitude then? Because we need to pray for continued freedom, but we also need to be willing to face up to whatever is going to come. It's no good saying, I'll serve the Lord as long as it's easy to do so. But if the government starts making it difficult, then you can't take that attitude, can you? You have to be committed to the Lord, whatever happens in the days to come. And so we don't react by rebelling against governments. We're not encouraged to do that in Scripture. Rather, we recognize the powers that be. And we see all the good that comes through legitimate state government. Then you think of the peace and the stability. Even in difficult regimes, at least there's some good that comes from what they do. And we're certainly to pray for state governments. No, we're to pray for all people. And that includes then those who have the rule over us. But we must be alert to the ways in which state power is often used against the truth. You think in this country, there's state-funded education. Now, you cannot in a classroom tell children that God made the world in 6 days. They won't let you do it. The state is opposed to that idea. And so we have anti-Christian education. You have to teach them evolution. Now, they should know about the theory of evolution. I'm sure that's true. But it is to be taught in such a way then that it is imposed upon them as though it was the truth. There are state-funded abortions. Our government pays then for little babies to be murdered in their mother's wombs. That happens. Now, nobody, as far as we're aware, is forced into that. But the state is funding that. It's paying. Some of the taxes that you and I pay, that goes then to funding abortions. And we must recognize that that's the case. There is state-funded support for sexual immorality. And I'm sure we can think of other examples of the same sort of thing. At the moment, you know, the government is looking into whether they can register Sunday schools so they can get their finger into Sunday schools and see what's going on and so they can decide whether they like it or whether they don't. They are continually then trying to promote Sunday trading then. We're aware of that, perhaps. And there are other things then that go on. I mean, in Scotland, there's a current move then to try and place every child in Scotland under, I forget the exact word they use for it, but an authorised person. And there are things that come like this then from time to time. And Satan will do everything he can to promote then evil in the state. And so we need to be diligent. We need to be prayerful. We don't need to be fearful, I don't think, but we need to be prayerful, and we need to recognize that such things happen. So that's the first thing then. Beware of satanic forces in politics today. I'm using the word politics in that general sense. Now, the second thing is this, to beware of satanic forces at work in religion today, in religion. You see, verses 11 to 18 brings us to, I suppose it's one of the most difficult passages in Revelation. It's the second beast, isn't it? This time there's another beast, isn't it? He comes out of the earth. And again, I think thinking about it, you know, how this plays out. For Israel then, there were these attacks from the sea, but there could also be attacks from, that were not external, but that were internal, that came from within. And so unlike the first gruesome-looking creature, this second one, he looks fairly innocent, doesn't he? He's got horns, yes, but they're lamb's horns. But we're told he spoke like a dragon. So behind his innocent looks, then, lurks the mind of the devil himself. And that's typical of Satan, of course, to disguise himself in order to take advantage of others. That's what Satan did it right at the very beginning, isn't it? When you open your Bible, you read about the creation and so on, and then you read about this snake and how Satan then disguised himself in that way. What does Jesus say? Jesus says, "Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ferocious wolves." I've said to you before, haven't I? Nobody will ever stand here and say, "I'm not a Christian. I want to encourage you not to be Christians either." They always say that. They'll say, "I'm a Christian. I think we've misunderstood some things in the past, and we need to change this and that." That's the sort of thing that that you can expect. It will be a subtle, it will be a veiled sort of approach. Writing to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 11, Paul says, "Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising then if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness." There's all sorts of deceit that goes on. And throughout the passage then, you're struck by the subtlety, the craftiness of this evil beast. And we should also note the way there is a deliberate, again, this parodying of all that's found in true religion. So you know, Christ is the Lamb, isn't he? He's the Lamb of God. And this beast then, he appears like a lamb. There are these apparent miracles, these signs that take place. There's the mark of the beast as opposed to the sealing of the spirit. There's a mark on believers. And so this beast puts a mark on his followers too. And it points us to the evil of false teaching and of false religion. And you see it everywhere, isn't it? I mentioned the Pope a moment ago. You know, people, he's so humble, isn't he? They say, "Isn't he a humble man? He's a lovely, lovely man, isn't he?" He's evil. And let's not be in any doubt about that whatsoever. This is the man who claims to be God's representative on earth. That's what he claims to be. He claims then to be the vicar of Christ. It's evil. It's evil. No other word for it. Or you think of JWs, isn't it? And they're pacifists, you see. And they're able then to present, and particularly people like that, their pacifists. Now, if you look into the JW teachings, it's a bit more complicated than that, but they tend to turn out to be pacifists. Or Hindus, you know, they're vegetarians. They don't want to harm God's creatures, do they? They just want to be, just want to eat lentils, and you know, it's always put over in that particular way. I like, did you know the Bob Dylan? There's a Bob Dylan song which I like some time ago. He talks about this this man. He says he's got a sweet gift of gab. He's got a harmonious tongue. He knows every song of love that ever has been sung. Good intentions can be evil. Both hands can be full of grease. You know, that sometimes Satan comes as a man of peace. That's how Satan sometimes comes, as a man of peace. Well, first he's in the background, then he's in the front. Both eyes are looking like they're on a rabbit hunt. Nobody can see through him. No, not even the chief of police. You know that sometimes Satan comes as a man of peace. He's a great humanitarian. He's a great philanthropist. He knows just where to touch you, honey, and how you like to be kissed. He'll put both his arms around you. You can feel the tender touch of the beast. You know, sometimes Satan comes as a man of peace. And he goes, as Bob Dylan does, he goes on at length in the same way. I think he's right, isn't he? That is what the Bible teaches us. And I'm sure it's because he's read the Bible that Bob Dylan has seen that. Whatever else he believes, I don't know. But he's got that from the Bible, hasn't he? So, what is it? Five things under this second heading. First of all, realize that false religions seek to promote the power of men. So verse 12 then. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf. And he made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. So the Roman Empire in John's day then was a sacralist state. Do you know that word sacral? So Religion and affairs of state were one then. They were bound together. So if you were a Roman citizen, you had to follow the Roman religion. That was the way it was set up. To be a good citizen, you had to follow Rome's religion. The two were intertwined. And again, that's happened then throughout history. You may remember how in Daniel's day, his three friends then, they ended up in the fiery furnace. Why? Because they refused to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. Daniel himself, later on, was thrown into a lion's den because he wouldn't follow the state religion. That was the reason. And one reason that John turns so much to the book of Daniel then is because of the way that period of time, when the people of God were away from the promised land, they were there in a pagan country, speaking a pagan language, living amongst pagans. That era then very much anticipates how it is in this gospel era. And similar things then have happened in the past in this country. You know the story of Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, and the way she burnt people. It was really all about who was to be obeyed then. Are you going to obey Mary, or are you going to obey the Bible? And those that wanted to obey the Bible, many of them lost their lives. We've mentioned the way it was under Hitler and under Stalin and Mao. And another example would be the way Islam and Roman Catholicism and certainly Orthodoxy, they're often working hand in glove with the state. They work with the state. And so they work together against true believers. So that's the first thing then, that we should realize that false religions seek to promote the power of men. And then don't be fooled if false religions produce apparent miracles, or signs they're called here, aren't they, to promote their cause. He performed great and miraculous signs then. He caused fire to come down from heaven in view of the people. Now again, Jesus tells us this, doesn't he? False messiahs and false prophets will appear. They'll perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. And there are many examples of miracles being used to support false religion. We must never for one moment assume that because somebody is able to perform an apparent miracle, he must be speaking the truth. This is one of the ways the charismatic movement has worked, in the Pentecostal movement in the past. He's done a miracle, therefore what he says must be true. No, it might be a false miracle, easily. And many false teachers then try and bolster their false teachings by these means. They claim that the healings that are supposed to have taken place, the wonders then, they are support. And sometimes these may be true, of course, but that doesn't mean to say that what they say is right. Think of, the Roman Catholics are very fond of Lourdes, isn't it, in France. And they say, oh, these wonderful healing miracles have taken place. Or think of the Hindu, have you seen these Hindus? They dig hooks into their skin and they pull great weights along and so on. Well, there's nothing miraculous about it because there are others that do exactly the same things and not in the name of Hinduism. But they're doing it there to try and impress you. And say, oh, well, this is wonderful. We have to follow this false religion. Excuse me. So don't be surprised that apparently defeated evil empires I've lost my point now. Oh, it's the second point, isn't it? Sorry. Don't be fooled, sorry, if false religions produce apparent miracles to promote the cause. Don't be surprised, thirdly, when unbelievers are taken in by false religions. So verse 14 and 15. Because of the signs it was given power to perform on behalf of the first beast, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth. It ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And the second beast then was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so that the image could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. So John is describing particularly things that went on in his own day. Ventriloquism we tend to think of as an entertainment thing these days, but ventriloquism and other tricks then have been used, particularly in the past then, to make statues appear to speak and to fool the people in those ways, as though there were oracles coming from heaven. That sort of thing. And by such means, an evil empires are upheld and many people are fooled. Now, believers are not fooled by those sorts of lies. But unbelievers, they are fooled again and again and again. So we mustn't get caught up then by these so-called miracles. You know, the wonders of modern science, as it sometimes... Just keep your head and don't just follow whatever's said. And then fourthly, false religion promotes discrimination against believers. Verse 16 and 17, it also forced all people then, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their forehead so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. Now, there's a temptation in some circles to take these verses very literally and expect that somewhere along the line, people will be expected to physically bear the 666 mark, you know, some sort of chip under your skin or something of that sort. I remember there was a lot of fuss about barcodes. Do you remember a few years ago, it's in the 70s now, that barcodes first came in. And it was supposed to contain 666. If you looked at a barcode, and I've looked this up, but it was beyond me, I must be honest, but it seemed to demonstrate his case that you can see 666 in all the barcodes. There was a woman called Mary Stuart Ralph, and she wrote a book in 1982 that revealed this apparent fact then. The New Money System 666, her book was called. There was, a 1993 film, a Michael Lee film called Naked, where a character actually talks about this and makes this this claim. Now, we've got to remember, this is still symbolism. This is symbolism. And so the point is that where possible, Satan will promote economic discrimination against believers. Believers in Smyrna were already suffering in that way when John wrote. And down the years, from time to time, the same sorts of things happen. And we can expect then that there will be economic disadvantages. I think there are. If you live in this country today as a Christian and you want to live out your Christian life, there are economic disadvantages in many cases that exist. And we mustn't be surprised at that. We must recognize that that will be the case. And so the final thing I want to say to you this morning, I'm sorry we're a bit long, but be wise and realize then that false religion is bound to fail. You see, verse 18 finishes off, doesn't it? This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast. The number is the number of man. That's the number. It is 666. And this verse, as you know, has been the subject of endless, mostly fruitless speculation. Did you ever see the 1976 film, The Omen? And I remember the bit, I haven't watched the whole film, but you know, is it Damien? And they look through his hair and they see tattooed into his head 666. So they know he's the Antichrist and so on. In Hebrew, in Aramaic, Greek and Latin, it was the practice, as I've said, to use the letters then for numbers. And so that means to say that the names can have numerical value. So Nero, you can do it with Nero. You can make Nero's name into 666. Now, I suppose John could be referring to Nero here, but I think the point is pretty clear, I'm sure, from what we've said before about numbers, that what John is doing here then is talking in quite different terms. How can we briefly explain it? God's number, now if you're following through Revelation, you know what God's number is. It's seven, isn't it? Seven is God's number. It's the number of completion. It's the number of perfection. Now, man was made on the sixth day. And his number then is six. And it's an imperfect, it's an incomplete number. That's its nature. It falls short of perfection. And it stands here then for failure. And it's three times, isn't it? So it's a complete failure. Failure, failure, failure. And false religion is man's religion, and it always fails. It always fails. It never attains to its goals. And it is destined then to fade away. Think of the false religions that have arisen over the years, only to pass away. The false cults of the Old Testament, to the early days of the church. And so it will be with today's cults. And even with the most resilient false religions, Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and Judaism, they will fade away. We can get quite fearful about false religions. You hear some people about Muslims or about Islam. You think, oh, it's something to be scared of. It's not at all. Islam is in decline. Then people are leaving Islam in their droves. The only growth that Islam is knowing is biological growth. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't things that so-called Muslims can do and Muslims can do, but it will die out. It will go. And it's not something that should particularly concern us. And so we see here the importance of a separation then between church and state then in this country. At the moment, you've still got a state church. It's very weak, it's very minimal, but it's still there. And it would be good to see that disappear. That's not how it should be. It shouldn't be that the Queen is the... Let me get the phrase right. She's not the head of the Church of England, but she's something like that. That's unbiblical. Shouldn't be the case. And we can see some of the harms that come from that. But above all, we must recognize that there are many false religions about, and we can never take the attitude that any religion will do. That's not right at all. We must oppose all false religion, however pleasantly it may be presented. And rather we must look to Christ then. Christ is the one who died for his people. He's the one who died to save his people. And it's as we trust in him that there's hope for us, even in difficult days like these.